Barry asked a while back how many of these I've got left to go, and I thought I had two books of the prophets left, but we've got three: Obadiah, Jonah, and Malachi. In case you're wondering why Zechariah hadn't found its way to the list, he's an eight-day meeting, so it's going to take some while to get that thing shortened down. I'm not going to go eight sermons in a row just on the book of Zechariah. So for what we have planned for now, we've got Obadiah tonight and the book of Jonah in one shot, and it'll take two shots to get the book of Malachi, even though it's a short book. It's full of important information. Obadiah is, I guess, the shortest prophet in terms of the length of his book. And that doesn't mean, though, that his book is short on intrigue and short on meaning. Discerning the exact time when this book was written is a chore. In fact, we really can't nail it down with certainty. We know that the book of Obadiah is about the foretelling the fall of the Edomite nation. We know that it's because of the things that the Edomites had done against the southern kingdom of Judah. Obadiah 1 and verse 10 talks about thy violence against thy brother Jacob. The southern kingdom had fallen prey to the Edomites' treachery, and there were different times in the history of the Edomites that they were guilty of this. There's a couple of different times that you narrow it down to when you're talking about when did Obadiah write. One of them is the mid-9th century B.C., and the other one is around the time of the Babylonian captivity. When you look at the time of the Babylonian captivity, the reason that I'm reluctant to place Obadiah's time frame there is because this book describes a level of conquest or vexation of Edom against the people of Judah that in Babylon's day they didn't really do. As I understand the historical account, yes, when Babylon was coming in and overthrowing Judean city, the Edomites were there to help their overthrow, and they were rejoicing in the overthrow of these Judean cities. Yes, they turned against their cousin nation while all that was going on. But Babylon turned right around on the Edomites and subjugated them as well. And Obadiah speaks as though this deals with a time that where the Edomites had a level of victory and vexation over the people of Judea, and it being a lingering circumstance. And the deal back in the mid-9th century B.C. sort of fits that a little bit better. You can line that up with some things in 2 Kings chapter 8. If you're looking for a specific place in the kings to pin this to, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judea during that particular time, and there was war back and forth between the Jews and the Edomites. And yet the Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah. So this was an ongoing revolt, and even though the Jews were able to attack them with some degree of success, the Edomites were able to attack the Israelites, or the people of Judea, with a degree of success. So that seems a little more similar to what we read about in Obadiah. And so that's where we're going to place the book. If you want to place it closer to the time of the Babylonian overthrow at about 550 to 600 B.C., somewhere along in there, if you want to put it there, you're not going to give me any heartburn. Just knock yourself out. To go back to our chart of the kings and the prophets that we've appealed to frequently, the way we've got it arranged, that would put Obadiah back here near the time of Joel and back near the days of Elijah and Elisha, the prophets of God from the northern kingdom. Now let's go into the first chapter, the only chapter of the book. Well, before I do that, let me show you the map real quick. I just realized I got to show you this. Obadiah deals with things pertaining to the Edomites and the people of Judea, but it also mentions in sort of a passing way some of the surrounding nations. A lot of these other nations, like the people of Tyre, the Philistines, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Nabataeans, these were nations that were allied with the Edomites at certain times. And at certain times, they joined them in turning against the people of Judah. And in the book of Obadiah, he mentions some of their allies turning against Edom. And that's why I show you where these others are located. So you get a sense that these are nations that sort of surround Judah. But they've kind of got the Edomites flanked too, the Nabataeans and the Philistines on either side there. As far as location relative to the other nations, the Edomites were exposed, though their capital was situated in a mountainous area, and it was very well fortified and very well protected. Positionally on the map, they were a little bit vulnerable. Now let's go into chapter 1 and read about their pride. The vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen, yet thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rocks, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? As far as nations go, the Edomites were a relatively small nation. When you start comparing them to the Babylonians and the Assyrians, and you think of the various Canaanite nations and even the nation of Israel, they were just not that big, but they displaced the Horites there in the mountain range of Seir. That you go from the Dead Sea there southward, it's a very rough mountainous area. It's high country. There's a lot of narrow canyons and wadis that you go through to get from point A to point B. And they built their capital city up in those mountainous rocky areas. If anybody remembers, there was a movie, one of those Indiana Jones movies, where they depicted them going to this lost city up in this really creviced mountainous area. That footage, that was filmed where the old Edomite capital was. And I'm bringing that up to give you a sense of these very narrow canyons. And it'd be very easy to place soldiers up on the high places. And you're trying to get a big army through these narrow ways. You can imagine that even though they were a small country because of where their capital city was situated, they were sitting pretty in their minds. And he's saying, God's saying, I'm doing you a favor. I'm sending an ambassador, Obadiah, to go amongst you heathen folk, because by this time their religion was pagan, heathen religion. And I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm doing you a favor, helping you to be prepared. Then he tells them, you're small. You're a small nation, but you think you're something. And that was their downfall, was their pride. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. And that's a message of varied messages we could sort of bear down on in the book of Obadiah. That's one I hope we can kind of have as our memorable thought from the book. Is you got a nation that was a very prideful nation that thought they had it made. And you know the New Testament warns us, to any who think he standeth, take heed lest you fall. We know over and over the Bible warns us about pride bringing about someone's downfall. Proverbs 16 verse 18, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 29 and 23, a man's pride shall bring him low, but honor shall uphold the humble in spirit. How many times does pride betray us? How many times does pride convince us that we're secure, or convince us that we're great, or convince us that we're something that we're really not? And that sets us up to be weak, and that sets us up to fall, and that sets us up to fail. And the very thing that would pretend to lift us up and exalt us, our pride, facilitates our crashing down. And what Edom experienced as a nation is very symbolic and appropriately depicts what can happen to you and I as individuals if we don't keep our pride in check. Now, they had an advantage with that being situated in all those crags and those rocks that we're talking about. I mean, if you're going to look at it from a strictly earthly standpoint, they had something to be proud of. From a sinful point of view, they had something that they could brag about. Because of where they were located, there were trade routes that passed through their borders. And in those ancient civilizations, if you could become a hub of the spice trade and the oils and the fragrances and foods and other things like that, you could make a lot of money off the trade. And so they had wealth pouring through their borders, and they had all this topographical advantage in where they were situated. A lot from a sinful human mind standpoint that they could be proud of, but that was the mistake they made. And the reason I say that is, you or I might look at our circumstance and we might become convinced that we've got a lot to be proud of. Maybe there are things you can point to that seem great. Maybe you've got a great family legacy, a great family that you're a part of. Maybe you've got a great job or great wealth or great achievement or a lot of talent. Maybe everybody just really adores you and admires you and thinks of you as a talented person. There might be any number of things that we would look at within ourselves and think of as an excuse to start, you know, lifting ourselves up. And Obadiah's book stands as a serious warning. This says, wait, stop. These guys had a reason to be uplifted too. But they let it get to them and it brought about their crashing down. They would be destroyed. He very quickly gets to that message. Obadiah 1 verse 4. Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers come to thee, would they not leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? God uses different figures of speech and different mental pictures to portray the idea you're going to get cleaned out. And they were. He said, you're nesting up there with the eagles. And they were up in their mountainous abode. But he says, that's where I'm going to bring you down from. The amazing thing about it is they were completely displaced, moved out of there. The Nabataeans went in and took their homeland away, and the Edomites had to go shuffle off to the land of Judah and try to fight and scratch for places to live there. That's what their eventual fate was. In fact, they were eventually absorbed into the nation of Judah. When you go to the first century, you won't read about, in the New Testament, someone who was known as an Edomite as part of that Edomite nation, because they were no longer a distinct nation. They were just part of the nation of Judah. The Herodian dynasty, the Herod's family, they're examples of that. They were, by bloodline, they were Edomites, but they were Jews just as much as everybody else, because that nation was brought down by God, crashing down from their lofty mountain, all because of their pride. They were deceived. He said, all the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed to the end that every one of the mountain of Esau may be cut off by slaughter? He says, your own friends, your own allies are going to deceive you and turn against you. And while they eat your food, they're going to wound you. And that's exactly what happened to the nation of Edom. Now, how do you march an army into that fortress? How do you march enough soldiers through those narrow canyons in order to get enough people in there to do something? Well, if you're a clever general, you don't. You think outside the box. You're a Nabataean general, and you've made yourselves a close ally to these people, and you've helped them in certain ones of their wars, and you've made close friendships, and you've invited them to your banquets, and you get an invitation to their banquet. And you bring all these people into their banquet to eat their food, welcomed as a friendly guest inside the city. You don't have to march through the narrow canyon ways with the archers shooting arrows at you from above. When you're an ally, you just sashay right on in with a supper invitation and start eating the man's bread. And that's what they did. They just sat there and feasted on Edomite hospitality. And the next thing you know, out come the swords, and the Nabataeans turned against the Edomites and slaughtered them all and went through the city slaughtering them all and opened up the passageways and the gateways to let the enemy hordes into the city, and it fell like a rock, just like that. God said, I will bring you down from your lofty perch. And you can imagine their mental response to that, bring us down. What army are you going to march in here? Don't think God can't figure out more than one ways to skin a cat. He can, and he did. And the Edomites were slaughtered. I mentioned the different allies turning against them. I had showed you on the map there the surrounding nations and the different alliances that they had had. Those were among the people that had turned against them, more particularly the Nabataeans. Obadiah 1, now verse 10. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever in the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem. Even thou wast one of them. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger, neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. This is one of those sections that make you wonder, is this talking about the period of the time of Babylon? But there were times earlier in Judah's history where things similar to this happened. He's got them rejoicing while Jerusalem is under attack. Jerusalem was under attack in other times besides when Babylon leveled the city. So there's a lot of different times in their history you could think about and think about this possibly fitting. But whichever way you take it, whatever point of time you place Obadiah at, the message is clear. They were prideful. They thought they couldn't be overthrown. And they're going to go down there in the lowlands where little brother lives, and they're going to kick him around a while. You know, that's one of those things, you start tracing that back through family lines, and that's one of those things that went all the way back to those twin boys, Jacob and Esau. The guys come out of the womb fighting each other, grappling for notoriety or for position or for being the elevated, exalted one. And they spent all their youth doing that, tore the family up. Jacob had to live apart from his family for many, many years. Finally came back and they finally made peace, he and his brother Esau. But their offspring didn't follow suit. When Israel was a beleaguered slave nation escaping the tyranny of Egypt and crossing towards their homeland in a way that wouldn't affect the Edomites one bit, the Edomites wouldn't let them pass through. Said, you pass through here, we'll attack you. Why? Just constant envy, bitterness, just yeah at each other. You know what I'm saying? Because of this fundamental prideful attitude that's been consistent throughout their history that made them at odds with a nation that should have been their friend and their ally in allegiance to God. Instead, they turned on their brother. And so would come upon them the day of the Lord. He said in verse 15, for the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink and shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. The Edomites are going to be destroyed, and it'll become as though they never existed as a nation. And by the first century, that was true. There's no trace of them left 2,000 years ago, and certainly no trace of them now. You still see remnants of those other nations, a lot of whom were sort of absorbed into nations around them, and some of the tribes and so forth, especially of that Arabian Peninsula. There's some of those tribes that can trace their lineage all the way back to Ishmael. But the Edomites, gone. And notice what God said to them here. As you have done, that's what's going to be done to you. Your reward will return on your own head. Think about the bad way they treated other nations and God saying, that's how you're going to be treated. Think about the threat of God's judgment in that kind of word. Think about this principle of pride bringing a person down. Think about our pride exalting us and it bringing us to a point of mind where we might mistreat other people or act hateful toward them or be haughty or something like that. And think of someday those tables turning. And it's not just somebody else kind of giving us the cold shoulder. It's God. What a frightful thought it would be to think that I would get what I deserved. That's what Edom's going to get. You know, when you serve the Lord faithfully, you don't have to worry about getting what you deserve because your sin is cleansed in the blood of Jesus. And in our faithful service to Him, we can continue to enjoy that cleansing if we're faithful in our service to Him. So that we don't have to reap what we really, really deserve on Judgment Day. But outside the grace of God, terror. The terror of a person's reward being brought back and returned on their own head. they shall be as though they had not been. He calls that occasion of God's judgment against Edom the day of the Lord. And I think we've talked before about this principle that the day of the Lord in prophecy is not always the end of time. Some expositors want to make it so, but it's just not true. A quick, easy example of that is Isaiah 13, verse 9. He says, "The day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them," he goes on to say later in that context. Look at a little bit further down. "And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah." So here God, through the prophet Isaiah, foretells that the Medes would be a part of the alliance that would overthrow the Babylonians. And it was the Medes and the Persians that jointly did that. But what did he refer to that as? He referred to that as the day of the Lord. Well, that wasn't the end of time. That happened centuries ago. That happened in, what, 536 B.C.? That'd been 2,500 plus years that happened. And yet, that was the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord in Scripture doesn't necessarily speak of the end of time. It's about a time of God pouring out His wrath. So when we read in the New Testament about the end of time, we shouldn't be surprised that He refers to that as the day of the Lord. Because all these other national destructions where God judges these sinful peoples, all those occasions foreshadow God's coming great judgment against sinful man. The occasion at which people outside of Christ get what they deserve. That's a terrifying thought. Where the proud will truly be brought low. Every knee bowing before Jesus. Every tongue confessing that He's the Son of God. The day of the Lord. Foreshadowed by all these other national destructions. And what happens afterward? Zion is established. God's rule is vindicated. He said, "Upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and they shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it." God says, "I've spoken. It's going to happen. You can write it down." And Obadiah did. And it did happen. We've talked at different times in the study of the prophets how there'll be an instance where he's describing something physical that would happen to the people of Judah. And then all of a sudden the language swells beyond the immediate occasion and begins to engulf concepts that did not happen in their national history but are spiritually achieved in the church. And I think this is one of those instances. You go back and listen to some of the other sermons on the prophets, and we will have talked about this some. It's a little bit of a complicated theme to develop, and there's a lot of New Testament passages that go hand in hand with this idea that I don't have time to go into this evening. I just want to sort of set before you the idea that he's sitting here describing Judah's ultimate victory over the Edomites, but then all of a sudden he brings Joseph into it. The house of Joseph, that was the Ephraimites. That was Israel. That was the northern kingdom. Hey, in 721, they were gone. They went the same way the Edomites went. They were just frittered away and lost as a nation because of their rebellion against God. Well, how would this be fulfilled? Well, you go into the New Testament and you read about the gospel ministry among the Samaritan people and those people obeying the gospel being welcomed into the spiritual family of God, and you've got your answer. That's triumphant spiritual Zion. You want to read about it in the New Testament? Go read Hebrews chapter 12, and you'll read about coming to Mount Zion, the general assembly, the church of the firstborn. So you see that old physical prophecy of physical events that did take place begins to swell in language that goes beyond their immediate circumstance and looks to the coming messianic age and his spiritual kingdom. And so this truth is accomplished in a real sense in the gospel ministry of the church and her spiritual borders that certainly go far beyond the little bitty tiny stretch of land over there in the nation of Israel. With the establishment of Zion as the vindication of the Lord's kingdom, He said, they of the south shall possess the mount of Esau. They shall of the plain of the Philistine, and they shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria. And Benjamin shall possess Gilead. And the captivity of the host of children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath. And the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. And Savior shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau. And the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Part of this might view some of the physical judges and leaders within the people of Judah during the Maccabean revolt, 160 give or take years before Christ. That's when a lot of the Edomites were subjugated, and it was a leader after Judas Maccabeus. Can't remember his name, but there was a Judean leader that vanquished the Edomites and forced them to convert to the Jewish religion, to be fully subjugated, never to rise as an independent nation again. But here again, we are reading all this language, and it sounds like he's describing something bigger than that. And I believe he probably is. He's describing what will ultimately be realized in Messiah's spiritual kingdom. But notice how he caps that off. Then the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Well, I'd like to ask a question. Let's just say this finds its fulfillment in 150 B.C., when by that time the Edomites were subjugated and wiped out, absorbed into Judah. So that's when the kingdom would be the Lord's. Was the kingdom not the Lord's before then? Well, of course it was. The kingdom belonged to the Lord all along. You just pick a time in Israel's history. I don't care what was going on. The kingdom belonged to God. But among men, in the sight of man, there was a vindication of that kingdom rule. There's an establishment or a statement of that authority. The kingdom belongs to the Lord today. The kingdom belonged to the Lord yesterday. When Jesus comes again in that final day of the Lord to exact God's judgment against the prideful, I want to tell you the kingdom will belong to the Lord, because it's going to be a statement when the proud are brought down out of their lofty nests. It's going to be a statement that proves God's authority and God's right to rule. Think about that when you study the idea of the kingdom in the Bible, the Old and especially in the New Testament, when you read about the kingdom. Think about that encompassing more than just the church. It certainly encompasses the church. But think of it embracing the idea of God's sovereign rule and His right to bear authority over His creation. And He has that right. And when He does something great to show His wrath against sin, it's just another occasion where His right to rule is made obvious. That's where that kingdom is the Lord, you see. He's making that statement, I'm in charge. In Acts 13 and verse 27, they that dwell at Jerusalem and their rulers, because they knew Him not, nor yet the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath day, they have fulfilled them in condemning Him. You see, they failed to listen and hear the voice of the prophets. The voices of men like Obadiah, they didn't get the message. We're trying hard to not make that mistake. We're looking for things in the message of Obadiah that would teach and speak to us. I know we're not Edomites. I know we're not dwelling in the mountain range of the old Horite nation there in Mount Seir. I know we're not sitting here thinking our capital city can't be overthrown. So in that sense, there's a message there that's specifically directed at the descendants of Esau. But there's also a message for us. We can look at their pride and how it brought them low, and listen well and learn something that's very important. Our own pride can be our own undoing. So let's humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, knowing that He'll be true to His promise and lift us up in due time. That would be the lesson I hope we could glean from the book of Obadiah. With that, we bring our study to a close. Have you humbled yourself before God and submitted to the gospel and become His child? If you've never been baptized into Christ, we'd like to give you the opportunity to do that now. Or if you're a Christian and you need the prayers of the church and you want to humble yourself before God, we'd love to assist you in that. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and sing.